Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I am doing great, doing real good. This is the live version of Fast Forward Radio, by the way.
And, absolutely right. We should point out that the show is now on three times a week, so this is for the really loyal followers, the second chance you've had to hear Fast Forward Radio this week, and we'll be on again Saturday evening, an hour later than this. So if you're listening at 7 o'clock Pacific or 10 o'clock Eastern, just add an hour to that on Saturday night, and we'll be running through the World Transform series. Actually, we're going to do the prequel program, the one that kind of set the agenda for that, coming up this Saturday.
World Transformed. It was that series of it was about 12 shows. We were stretching on that deal. We really got some awesome guests in that series, and it's worth listening to again if you've already heard it.
This is a good opportunity to kind of refresh your mind about these issues. Because we will be in early 2011, late part of January and on into February, be beginning The World Transformed Part 2, our new series that will be involving many of the same people plus some new voices and a further, deeper exploration of many of the issues that we got into in The World Transformed. And boy, that was we did kind of push the envelope with that series, didn't we?
Oh, yeah. I got to hand it to you on that, Phil. You booked most of those guests, I believe, or all of them, I think. It was great. That was a good series. Can't wait to do it again with the World's Transformed Part 2. But anyway, for tonight, too, though.
Well, we got a terrific show. I should say that I am coming to you this evening through the magic of Google Voice technology. So I'm giving this a try. I was going to do Skype because Skype is actually what Blog Talk Radio runs on now. They apparently have some built-in Skype functionality, and that's why there's a slight audio delay between your two hosts, making it impossible for us to sing any more duets in the future, unfortunately. sorry, fans, but that's the way it is.
That's not a bug. That's a feature.
Possibly a feature. So I was going to call in using Skype, and I tried to log in to Skype, and Skype wanted me to pay money to dial in. And I said, oh, no, not in the age of Google Voice, where you can call any landline in the world pretty much for no charge. Am I going to pay to make a phone call? It's funny how quickly, instantly, something that seemed perfectly reasonable becomes intolerable. Because, you know, there is nothing unreasonable about the fees that Skype charges unless someone else is letting you do it for free. And then suddenly it's like, well, that's it. I got to go with free. So I'm trying this out. I prefer the sound quality of internet voice over IP. And I'd like to do it this way. We test this periodically. In the past, we've not had great success with it. So we're trying it out tonight. Appreciate any comments anyone wants to leave on the blog or any comments from the chat as to how it's sounding. If we sound like we've got an additional delay, if I sound funny, any of that kind of stuff would be very helpful to us.
Absolutely. Yeah, we want to we want to provide the best show possible with as long as it's free, right, Phil? So I mean,
the show will remain free for the time being, at least. when we hit the big time, we'll do like Dennis Miller does, right? He has the DMZ. I don't know if you ever listen to his show. I listen to it sometimes on the way to work. And I guess a lot of these talk radio folks do this, where they have a website and you can download additional podcasts and you can listen to all the archives of the show, but you have to pay for that.
Yeah.
And think about it. We offer all that absolutely free. Not only free to access the archives, but we're actually rebroadcasting the archives with additional commentary.
That's right.
Because we care, I think, is what it comes down to.
Yeah.
Because we love you, folks.
Yeah. It's more of a beautiful obsession. But anyway, we provide it. We really are giving kind of guys. So yeah.
Yeah, we are. We're just givers. That's all there is to it. I got a warm fuzzy feeling just thinking about how awesome we are. Okay, let's get this show on the road. We're talking about all things astounding this evening. We've got some interesting facts from the world of science. We've got some interesting facts from elsewhere. And we're going to be talking a little bit about our own predictions for technologies coming in the next 2 decades, a survey that we ran earlier this week. So I don't know where to delve into this, Stephen. Where do you want to go first with this?
Okay, well, I guess it's something we could just come up with. Basically, you had sent me a link, Phil, to just basically some random facts, and I thought it was pretty interesting. I kind of went through some of those facts, and I pulled out one and told my son about this particular fact. Apparently, you cannot fold a sheet of paper more than 7 times. That's what I told him. That's what the fact said, and so he immediately said, "Well, that's not true." According to what I saw on MythBusters, you can fold a sheet of paper 8 times. It is possible. Of course, special equipment is involved. But anyway, he grabs the sheet of paper and he goes into another room. And I hear this hammering going on. He got it to 7. He got it to 7-fold. Basically, taking a sheet of paper, folding it in half, folding that in half, folding that in half. He got to 7 times, but that's as far as he could go without pulling out a vice or something.
Well, good on him for giving it the old try. And you've got to love the new generation that doesn't take astounding facts from their dads sitting down, right? It's like, oh, no, you don't, Mr. Father. Let me just tell you what I know from watching the Discovery Channel, okay? That's great. But actually, that's the point of astounding facts. They're here to amaze and delight and hopefully to foster interesting conversation and to get us thinking a little bit differently about the world. I have always been a sucker for amazing facts. I think I mentioned to you before the show started this evening that the reason I had come to this site is greatfacts.com, by the way, for those following along who want to read some astounding facts for themselves. I always incorporate these into whenever I do sales training or any kind of training. I always like to start out quizzing the group with fun facts. And did you read the one about the 3 most best-known Western names in China?
The 3 most Western names in China are Jesus Christ, Elvis Presley, and Richard Nixon, right?
Richard Nixon, you did read that one. Okay, so that's a great stumper to pull on people, okay? I can tell you that I pulled that on an international crowd last week, and a lot of Americans in the room, but also Asians, people from all over the world. And without hints, they didn't come up with one of those, okay? And after they got Nixon and Elvis, I pretty much had to hand them Jesus on a plate, okay? They weren't going to get that no matter what. So that's a fun one. I recommend using that one whenever possible. Also, the fact that the name Wendy was made up for the book Peter Pan. Did you know that?
I'm not sure if that one's true, because I thought that he basically took the names of those of the kids in that particular family. I know there was a Michael and a Peter, and I thought that there was a Wendy in that family too. So
now you're challenging greatfacts.com, okay?
Yeah.
Stephen, I will tolerate this from children, okay? But I really back off, man.
Well, I'm gonna
I don't know. It struck me as strange too, but It's interesting if true, that's for sure. Anyone in the chat room who can get us the down low on whether what's the guy's name? J.J. Barry invented the name Wendy for the book Peter Pan, or whether that was a pre-existing name, let us know. Okay, how about this one? I'll give you one more, and this one's kind of scientific.
Okay.
Humans are born with 300 bones in their body. However, when a person reaches adulthood, they have only 206 bones. This occurs because many of them join together to make a single bone.
Yep.
Did you know that?
Yeah, I did. We all know that the bones in our skull fuse.
Right.
You know, when babies are born, they have a soft spot that you have to be careful of and all that. Well, that's part of the skull having not been fused yet. By the time a child is three or so, their skull is pretty much fused. But there's lots of other bones that fuse in your body as well. For example, most adults do not have a fused bone basically in their pinky toe. You don't have all the joints in your pinky toe that adults.
You know, I'm seeing in the chat room that they're not getting any sound. Apparently they were hearing us, and now they're not. So,
well, I don't know what to do about that besides just carry on. Hopefully it's our show is recording, so I guess we'll just keep going.
It will be available via MP3. Excuse me. Please let us know when you've got sound back there. Of course, you can't hear me say this. So, anyway, hopefully they'll let us know when the sound comes back. Okay. Any other astounding facts from Great Facts that caught your attention?
Well, that's about it. Every one of them is interesting. It's like potato chips. You can't stop reading them. I read through a bunch of them, I thought it was interesting. I didn't know this, that the pyramids were once completely white. They were covered with limestone that's since worn away. I thought that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I knew that they were covered with a different smooth surface, but I didn't realize that they were pure white. They must have been as spectacular as they are now. Imagine what that must have looked like a few thousand years ago when they were just this smooth white, you know, on a moonlit night, those pyramids sitting there. That must have been quite a sight.
Must have been pretty cool. And the Greeks and things were all painted. That's kind of weird. Can you imagine the Parthenon painted, you know?
I know. This classic Greek look of white marble is because of bleaching over time. The ancient Romans and ancient Greeks actually painted all their temples and all their public buildings, so they looked completely different than the way we picture them from the movies. Okay, how about this one? Color is not an indicator for the taste or ripeness in cranberries. Did you know that?
Well, that's unusual because just about any other fruit you can tell by the color. Isn't that interesting?
That's what makes that an astounding fact. Well, plus, I guess the thing is, have you ever like bitten into like an uncooked, unsweetened cranberry?
No, I have not.
See, I think the point there is that it really doesn't matter if they're ripe or not, right? It tastes exactly the same. It's just like, wah! they're unbelievably sour and bitter fruit. They're really, I think it's safe to say inedible, actually, without...
You pretty much... It was a challenge. What in the world can we do with this? And then they went to work on it and made it edible. And you know, I'm sure that they went through much the same with acorns and never found a use for it. So they were never able to make it edible at all.
Yeah, that's right. And they ought to be, right? Because they're so abundant. But by golly, you just there's no eating acorns. That's the bottom line. How about this? Instead of a birthday cake, many Russian children are given a birthday pie.
I think that's pretty cool.
I do too. That is an admirable cultural artifact in Russia. I think the rest of the world would do well to pick up on that because I'd love to get a birthday pie. You know, probably
okay, well,
could.
So,
if I ask,
what is your best pie? Favorite pie?
Ooh, that is a tough one. Well, this is a real cliche, but my mom makes a heck of an apple pie. There you go. I'm going to say my all together, and I love America, so there it is. And I'm a baseball fan. You know, I think I'm going to go with pecan pie. I think my all-time favorite pie would be pecan pie. How about you, Stephen?
There are particular. I guess I'll go with pecan pie as well, but probably a huckleberry cobbler that my grandmother made was probably the most fantastic dessert I've ever had in my life. So there you
go. Sounds awesome, but I didn't know we were counting cobbler. Okay, so you, I asked pie and you whipped out cobbler on me. Okay.
Oh,
so.
Well, I'm sorry. Yeah.
It's okay. I don't know if in Russia you can get a birthday cobbler, but that would.
That's right.
But come think of it, my mom used to make an awesome blackberry.
It's astounding desserts tonight. Is the
I feel that we're digressing somewhat, even from our rather loose outline for what the show is going to be. Perhaps we'll come back to great facts and delight the audience with some more astounding facts here a bit later. No, there's still having trouble, it looks like. VLC keeps reporting that it can't open the source and the flash thing isn't working after the initial Blog Talk Radio. Well, so sorry for those listening live. Hope you're hearing this on the record, if nothing else, that we're having audio difficulties. We're going to continue because we're assuming it's recording. If we can hear each other, that's usually the case, right?
That's right. We've never known it not to record. Well, we can't say that either. We've had every conceivable type of hitch as possible we've experienced at one point or another. So we're just hopeful that this show is recording in the net.
One evening we had Philip Van Netterveld on. I believe we came up with ultimately solutions to all of humanity's problems on that program. And sadly, the audio
didn't
was
record.
Lost.
The audio was lost, and we can't remember a word of what anybody said. So sorry.
No, it was a wonderful. We remember that the solutions were there and they were sound, but that's all. That's all anyone took away from that. So sadly. It's not our fault. It's Blog Talk Radio. Okay, so I'll tell you what. I'm going to shift gears, and let's talk a little bit about the speculative survey we did. This was a fun one, especially because we got insta-lanced on that, so we got a significantly more response to our survey than we have for the first few. I mean, I appreciate anyone who takes the time to complete one of our surveys, but it's really nice when you get we got nearly 1,000 responses this time out, so that was kind of fun to see those larger numbers. Here's what happened. Christian Henrik Nashim, who runs ilookforwardto.com, asked myself and several other futurists to answer this question. The question was, if you had to guess, what will be the single most significant technological development in the coming 20 years and why? And I thought, well, that's a great question to try to wrap your head around. Let's make a survey out of that.
So of course, you gave some choices, and I thought there were some pretty good choices, but there are a couple of things that were not mentioned that I thought should have been mentioned, but that's okay. You also had a catch-all other. So.
I always put at least one other category. Sometimes I do multiple others, but the options I gave were artificial intelligence, energy, genetic research, nanotechnology, space, transportation, and other. Now, what other categories might I have included?
Well, life extension, for example, might have been included, you know, perhaps 3D printing might have been included.
You're right. I maybe got too specific on genetic research and nanotechnology. Those could have been bioscience and material science or something like that. Maybe would have.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not criticizing. No.
Sure. That's good feedback. Those were more specific maybe than they needed to be, because I was actually trying to give broad categories. And maybe I got a little more specific than I intended. That's a good point. Although I think that those who answered genetic research, by and large, were reading that as it being kind of the key to life extension. And nanotech. Well, here's my take on how people answered this. And maybe I'm bitter because my own choice didn't come in first. But the way I'm reading the comments and the fact that nanotechnology took the day with upwards of nearly 400 people picking that one, I think is because people were not answering which one is going to provide the biggest breakthrough in the next two decades as much as they were answering which one of these is going to bring the biggest change eventually. And I think that's a different question, right? Although I still think maybe artificial intelligence would take the day there. But will you tell me, do you think that people were answering the question as stated or more along the lines of what I just said?
I think that they all interpreted it particular ways. If they think that life extension is the most it will be the greatest thing that could come along in the next 20 years, they probably would have chosen genetic research.
Yeah.
They're thinking about something else, they would have chosen another one of those categories, and then they might have if they had the opportunity to even explain it in the comments with the why they chose their particular topic. So. Yeah, it was a good survey. It was a good survey, but I mean, of course, we have more to say about it now, though. So that's why.
Well, here's what I would say. I chose artificial intelligence, and the answer that I wrote was really not about people. I think one of the misunderstandings that I contributed to there was people read that as strong AI, and actually, I meant anything in the artificial intelligence field. And my own answer has to do with migrating human intelligence to a new substrate. And I don't mean that via uploading. I just mean kind of the completion or continuation of the process that you and I have talked about so many times, the fact that you count all the information that you can access via Google as part of your own memory, right? I think you've said that a couple times on the show, and I think that's exactly right. The fact that our intelligence is becoming completely correlated with, interdependent with, intermingled with machine intelligence, and that's going to be boosted tremendously by the introduction of a really important new technology. John Smart has talked about it when he was on the program, and we've talked about it a few times, and that's the conversational user interface. When we're able to interact with machines the way you and I are able to interact with each other, essentially, the level of interconnectedness between us and information technology is going to explode. I mean, we think we're well connected and well wired in now, but it's going to go a lot farther than anything we've ever imagined. And I guess the reason I chose that one is I certainly hope the nanotechnology occurs between now and 20 years. I if we get to like diamondoid or replicators or something like that, that'd be great. I hope that life extension occurs if we get measurable real life extension technology occurring, but I thoroughly expect this one to happen. 20 years from now, I would be extremely surprised if this one didn't happen, right? If those others happen, I'll be pleasantly surprised that they did, or pleased that they did, but not really having thought, yes, that's definitely going to happen within the next 20 years, right? So I was reading the time frame as a hard stop, and that's how I was trying to predict something that you can say for sure is going to happen 20 years from now. What do you think, Stephen? What's your answer to the question?
Well, let me. I want to give you what I believe is a pretty sure bet. Okay.
Okay. All right.
Next 20 years, I want to tell you that whatever will turn out to be the most important technology that is developed in the next 20 years will be a technology that will serve as a platform upon which other things can be built. It'll open up possibilities that weren't available before, and that's what will make it so important. And let me give you an example. Probably the best example in history would be Gutenberg's printing press. It enabled affordable books that increased the amount of books that were out there in the world and allowed exchange of ideas, which then basically the Renaissance, the Industrial Revolution, and all these things that followed. No printing press, no modern world. you know, period. That's a great enabling technology that allowed, you know, so much to flow from it. You know, and you know, and there's other technologies like that. I mean, you know, no telephone, no internet. You know, if we don't have an internet, we don't have a World Wide Web. If we don't have World Wide Web, we don't have YouTube, blogs, podcasting, eBay, Twitter, you know, all these things. So I would say that, you know, the most important future developments will enable the rest of the future that we, you know, that we all dream about, you know, the flying cars and the whole works. So what technologies could enable something? Well, I would say, you know, super intelligence or greater than human intelligence would be one. If by whatever means, artificial general intelligence or human enhancement or whatever, we get greater than human intelligence, that's, you know, that leads to everything, doesn't it? I mean,
exactly. Yeah.
That's Pandora's box right there. Radical life extension, in a way, it's kind of like that because it gives us more time to get to everything. You know, I mean,
that's right.
If we can live to see it, then, you know, that's, in a way, that's giving us all these things too. And you know, and maybe less radically, something like 3D printing, digitizing the real world. We have, you know, we exchange ideas on the internet right now, but that's the extent of it. We exchange ideas. 3D way kind of allows us to exchange real world items. It's almost like a transporter, almost. You know, I mean, if I have, you know, some great idea for, you know, the world's greatest iPod here at, you know, here in Shreveport, I could put those designs out there and let somebody with a 3D printer, if they had a 3D printer that could handle it, they would just print it at their house. And so I think that'll be a great enabling technology that allow lots of personal innovation. So there's that. So those are my ideas. I'll just throw them out there.
Okay. Now you got to pick one. What's the one that's going to occur in the next 20 years?
In the next 20 years, 3D printing is an easy low-lying fruit. We've already got 3D printing. It's just very primitive. It'll continue to be refined. We will definitely have 3D printing. So that's an easy one. And of course, I'm already on record saying that we're going to get some form of early life extension, you know, in the next few years. I think what are we now to about 11 or 12 years?
That's right.
My countdown, something like that. So
we'll need it, you know, pretty soon here, so that your prediction comes true. That's the important thing. Then
exactly.
Also another benefit of that would be there will be life extension. So it's just a big win-win if
exactly.
It shows up, right?
Secondarily, well, you know, millions will be saved. So
yeah, exactly. So you know, it's a good thing all the way around if that will just show up in a timely way. Well, and this goes to, I guess, the other part of the question, which is what will be the biggest impact? Because there's no question that we will have developments in all of these areas over the next 20 years.
Yeah.
And I guess so. I guess the question is, where's the one where we make a real leap? And I think if you enter something that is understood to be and credibly accepted as this will add 5 years to a human life, that's so huge, right? I mean, that is so enormous, because that you know, through better health and better diet and cleaner living conditions, we've increased human lifespan over the years, but we've never been able to say, okay, now we're going after the core thing. Now we're going after aging itself, and we're going to roll it back, you know, even a tiny bit, right? Even one click. If a treatment is developed that rolls that back, that is a sea change, isn't it? That is a discontinuous change.
Yeah, and once you see that it could be rolled back one click, the question that will follow is, well, why not two clicks? You know,
exactly.
Is there, and so, you know, it's one, and once the first life extension billionaires are made, can you imagine how many other people will be chasing it? So it's going to be a huge deal, and I'd be very surprised if, you know, here we are in 2010. I would be very surprised if in 2030, Phil, there's not you know, there's not some, you know, some form of life extension that we would call radical today. So I would be very, very surprised. So
I hope so. I hope that's true.
We'll both.
I'm looking forward to it. I mean, 2030,
yeah.
Whew, 20 years from now. Well, I add 20 to my current age. Yeah, I'll be ready for it. Let me tell you.
It will not
be a moment too soon.
Yeah, exactly. I will be 61 and, you know, not ancient, but I'm sure I will be ready to be a little bit younger at age 61. So, yeah.
Absolutely. But I want to go back to an idea that you mentioned that I think is really important. I think this is a profound idea that you've introduced, and I think you're absolutely right. In one of our conversations about nanotechnology, I think it was with J. Storrs Hall, but I'm not sure. We got into this place of talking about before we can have the actual nanofactories, we need the nano machine tools. You know, we need the tools that are going to build the tools that are going to make nanotechnology possible. And
right.
That's the same idea I think that you're referring to here when you talk about this enabling technology, the substrate that's going to make it possible for us to move ahead in one of these areas. And I really think, to a very real extent, that the conversational user interface, as kind of bland as it sounds when you describe it, it's like, oh, well, so it's another user interface. But I actually think it becomes one of those great enabling technologies. I think that it will make the path to artificial general intelligence that much easier. And if
right.
we are to believe, as Michael Anisimov argues, that the correct way to get to nanotech is through artificial general intelligence, it then becomes kind of the enabling technology both for AGI and for true nanotech. So not in a defending my answer kind of way, but just in a this really is huge when it arrives kind of way. I want to just make the point that it's a biggie, and it's one that we probably don't give as much thought to as we should. But once it shows up, I think things are really going to start changing rapidly. And of course, AGI can also help us to get to life extension. It's as you said, Stephen, superintelligence is kind of the enabler for everything.
That's right. Well, you know, talking about your conversational user interface, I mean, the way Kurzweil described it in his books, Singularity is Near and The Age of Spiritual Machines, those two books, what he was describing was basically a digital assistant who serves as sort of your secretary, in a way. And you know, imagine the person who never, you know, is having a bad day, is always, regardless of how stupid your request, for something is, it always is, immediate and gets you exactly what you need and organizes, whatever it is, that your searches or whatever. And that's what we're talking about. And, he basically imagines a future where people build relationships with these personalities, and that get more and more complex as the years go by. Anyway, it's kind of an interesting thought, and yes, I think that it will be huge. And so let me hear from you, Phil. When do you think we will start seeing this? Because I mean, we already, in some ways, we've got expert systems that in narrow fields can experts, and we have voice recognition systems that are getting better. When do we get all these parts put together and get our personal digital assistant that Kurzweil was thinking about?
Well, in his paper on the subject, John Smart pinpoints an era between 2012 and 2019. He sees it kind of occurring gradually over that period of time. So. It starts as early as 2012, and we're really fully there, probably well before 2019. But I'll just I'll plop a nice round sounding year right out of the middle of that, and I'll say 2015. So 5 years
okay.
from now, I think we will be interacting with computers in a way that we have thought about and certainly seen in science fiction and so forth over the years, but we'll truly be talking to them the way we talk to each other. That's coming up soon.
Here it is, 2010, and I have an iPhone, and it's got an app on it. It's a Google search app. And, of course, it's got voice recognition, which is very good, by the way. The voice recognition requires no training at all. But I can just, you know, tell it something I'm interested in it looking up. And, you know, it looks it up. And, you know, there it is. Now, it would be nice if it also read it to me, which, you know, that wouldn't be that big of a to add that functionality to it. And, of course, it needs to be, you know, get to where it's conversational. And that's, you know, that requires a whole nother level of sophistication. But it seems like we're beginning to see that the technology is put together even now. So,
well, yeah. one of the things that John points out is the word length of searches, of text searches, how much more sophisticated our searches have become over the years, and we haven't thought about that. But he talks about when Alta Vista was first introduced in the late 90s, people would put a word in, or maybe a couple of words. And now people put in large phrases. They put in grammar. There's an expectation, and often a correct expectation, that Google or whatever Bing, whatever search engine you're using, is actually going to be able to process that and provide an answer that's meaningful. And sometimes you hit and sometimes you miss. But we're already having a much more sophisticated dialogue with them than we did even a few years ago, but it happens so gradually that it doesn't occur to us that change has occurred. And I think that even going to full blown conversational mode, we'll probably see it more in the rearview mirror than we'll see it coming. It'll be one of those things where it's like, well, I guess we're kind of doing it now, aren't we? And we'll think, oh yeah, I suppose we are. But it will still be huge because of the changes that it promises to bring.
You'll say, I guess we're kind of doing it now, and your computer will say, yeah, I guess we kind of are. So
yeah, I suppose we are. Yeah. or worse yet, it'll go, not really, no. That would be bad.
Your computer says, no, you haven't quite passed the Turing test, Phil. Sorry.
Yeah, you don't understand what's going on here. That would not be great. Okay, so I think that does it for our discussion of the survey. Thanks to everyone who participated, and we run a survey just about every week, not every single week, but just about every week. So we'll have another fun one coming up, I'm sure next week or the week after. I'll tell you what, let's do now, Stephen. While we've got a few minutes, let's talk about the list of weird physics facts that we have. Those are some astounding facts, and I think we'd like to lump those into a category for a little feature that we like to call
Astounding Science Facts.
Ah, very nice. When was the last time we had a set of astounding science facts, Stephen? It's got to have been a year ago, probably, since we.
Well, seems like we had. Didn't we dust that off like 3 or 4 weeks ago? But it had been like a year and a half before that. It seems like we've done it here recently once.
Oh, did we? I knew we did Tales of the Paranormal, but I couldn't remember if we had done this. I'm glad we did, if we did, because this is a great feature. I'm glad we're keeping it going. But this was fun. I actually picked this up off your Twitter feed, and I guess Roger Ebert had linked to this, so that's kind of fun that we're now getting content from Roger Ebert. But did you read this article, The 10 Weirdest Physics Facts from Relativity to Quantum Physics?
Yeah, and now, you know, the first facts listed I take issue with. So it's always funny, the you know, the facts are sometimes, you know, sometimes they're facts and sometimes they're not, but at any rate. Yeah, it's a great article. It's definitely worth looking at. And
now you've brought it up. What's the first fact, and what's the issue? That's good. This makes it entertaining.
Okay. If the sun were made of bananas, it'd be just as hot as it is today. Okay.
Okay.
So, and, you know, basically it would not. It requires hydrogen that basically creates a nuclear furnace that gives it what it is. Now, they came back, and there have been so many people that took issue with this. Now the thing is this: no matter what you make a star out of, if it's bananas, if you had enough bananas to make a star out of it, it would create great heat. Why? Because of the gravity pulling it together under colossal pressure. It says here, just as a bicycle pump gets warm when you pump it, the pressure increases temperature. Enormous pressure leads to enormous temperature. And they had to come back and say, here's the edit that they brought in. This might be a little confusing. The heat caused by the internal pressure would be similar to that of our sun. However, if it's not made of hydrogen, the fusion reaction that keeps it going wouldn't get it underway. So a banana sun would rapidly cool down from its initial heat rather than burning for billions of years, thanks to the people who pointed this out. I love it that there were multiple people that pointed that out. That's what makes that great, you know. But,
I'm sorry, a little bit of nerdiness in action, I think, right?
We've
crossed the line from geek to nerd at this point, right? When you read that fact and you go, not so fast with your, if the sun were made of bananas, it would be just as hot. But to be truly nerdy, I think you'd have to correct somebody in a social setting. But I think, writing into him is, the folks who went to the trouble to do that, that's still fairly nerdy. However, the point is, you would get the same heat as the initial condition. You just don't get the sustained heat because bananas would not... Oddly enough, bananas would not lead to a sustained fusion reaction. It's funny to me too, because you know what I start thinking? Okay, what if you had regular sun and then you had banana sun and you dropped banana sun into regular sun? Would the fusion reaction burn the bananas then? I would have thought that anything, if you got it hot enough, would be subject to a fusion reaction, but I guess that the initial conditions of the sun are not great enough heat for bananas to go thermonuclear on you. So if anyone in the chat room can do the math on this and let me know exactly how hot you would have to get bananas before they went.
This is an exact situation where it would be good to have Brian. If Brian Wong were on the show, he could answer the question for us whether bananas would go thermonuclear on us.
Or at what point? I think everything will at some point. It's just a question of how condensed and how hot you'd have to get them before they'd, you know, break down into, you know, more fundamental parts. That's a great one. It's great because we have the astounding fact to begin with that bananas would be really super hot if they were the size of the sun, plus the fun correction. Now here's this next one. Let's see if this one stands or if you have a correction on this one. All the matter that makes up the human race could fit in a sugar cube. And it goes on to explain that atoms are 99. And I'm going to count this. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. I'm seeing 13 nines. Okay, so 99.13 9s% empty space. As Tom Stoppard put it, make a fist, and if your fist is as big as the nucleus of an atom, then the atom is as big as St. Paul's. And if it happens to be a hydrogen atom, then it has a single electron flitting about like a moth in an empty cathedral, now by the dome, now by the altar. Okay, so you get an idea of the amount of stuff in an atom versus the amount of empty space in an atom. So everything that is actually something in the universe, not everything in the universe, but if all the people, if you took all the matter that makes up all the people on the planet, it would fit in a sugar cube. And that'd be one heavy sugar cube.
Yeah. Well, that's obviously where the atoms are actually being crushed into, you know, each other to the point that, you know, they're probably no longer like atoms, you know, they're not behaving as atoms anymore when they're crushed together like that. They have to have the orbits and everything functioning properly. So, yeah, I find that interesting. And, you know, I've actually heard things like, deep down, all matter is basically information anyway. It's more information as to how space should react to itself more than more than being a solid object. But anyway, that's some pretty weird physics there.
So. It is. I mean, yeah, if you get into string theory and stuff, and it's just these vibrating strings, and what we think of as particles, what we think of as the stuff that would be in that sugar cube, is really just a vibration. At that point, you say, well, then it's not even a sugar cube. It's just nothing, right? There's no actual stuff at all. But
there's no stuff there. We're just basically, there's no hardware. There's just software running on a.
It's all software. Yeah.
It's all software running on a celestial computer somewhere. So. Interesting stuff.
We're
right here in the middle of it. Okay, I guess so. The next one, almost all of the universe is missing. Now, and what's funny is this is not even related to the last thing. It's the universe is missing in a totally different way than what we were talking about a second ago. There's probably more than 100 billion galaxies in the cosmos. Each of these galaxies has between 10 million to a trillion stars in it. Et cetera, et cetera. Our sun, a rather small and feeble star, weighs about a billion tons, and most are much bigger. So there's lots of visible matter in the universe, but it only accounts for 2% of the universe's mass as calculated it ought to be. So that's interesting. where's the rest of the stuff? They've come up with all kinds of theories to say where is this stuff and matter is a big part of, dark energy. And so where is everything? We're just not seeing it. It's there, but it's not,
It's there, but we can't find it. And it's most of the universe, which means that the dark matter universe might be the real universe. And we're just like this little pocket thing, right? The really interesting stuff might be going on over there in the dark matter that we can't detect. But we'll never know because... We can't detect it. We don't know how we would ever know. I put it that way.
Yeah.
So that is pretty freaky. How about this one? Actually, we skipped one, which is events in the future can affect what happened in the past. And I'm not going to try to explain this one. I'll just reference the fact that this has to do with the double slit experiment, which I think we've talked about that before on the show, have we not?
Yeah. Basically, what is observed... from the unobserved universe, basically there's probabilities until, and then the universe decides which it's going to be, So, but how does that affect the past though? The fact that I observed it, it means it was that way all along. Is that what they're trying to say?
I said I don't want to try to explain this because I always get horribly wrapped around the axle trying to talk about this thing. But basically, the double slit experiment has a set of conditions that is variable depending on whether you record the information or not. So the outcome comes out one way if you record it and comes out another way if you don't record it. And apparently the act of erasing it after you record it, these are metaphors we're speaking in. This isn't exactly what it is, but just to give you an idea, can in the future can actually change the way it occurs in the present or the past. I'll provide a link to a page that explains it better than I just have. But yes, it comes down to somehow things that are done after the experiment impact the experiment as it's occurring. The future actually somehow seems to come back and change the past.
This is very, very strange. It's all, it makes it almost seem as though. Give me an example. When you are playing a video game, one of the ways that they save on computation so that they don't have to, let's say you're in a 3D world and your character is, it's a first person shooter program, and so you've got your gun and you're sneaking along in this dungeon or whatever, searching for monsters or whatever in the computer world. Your computer does not calculate the entire world. It builds the world just right around you, okay?
Right.
And so if there might be something going on and elsewhere in the world, but that part of the world's not built. it almost seems as though, to some extent, the universe that we live in exists when we see it. Does that mean, am I overstating it? That at all?
I think that's a really interesting analogy. I'm sure that a real physicist would immediately give a reason why no, that's not true. But that sounds right to me, based on the probably crude and inaccurate way I described the double slit experiment. That sounds exactly like what's happening. Like we're only seeing as much of the universe as it has to show us to save compute cycles, and the rest of it's not there when we're not looking. Right? That's the basic idea.
Which is pretty wild. That's pretty awesome. Anyway, do we have time to go through any more?
Let's hit one more. Pick the best
one. All right.
Actually, I'm gonna pick one more, and then you can pick one.
Yeah, pick one more. Go ahead.
I have to read this one. There are an infinite number of me's writing this and an infinite number of you's reading it. So there's an infinite number of us, Stephen, doing this program. And here's what I like about this. We actually have an infinite audience. Okay? So it's well spread out over the entire multiverse. But that's a pretty familiar idea. I mean, if that one blows anyone's mind, it's not regular speculist readers or fast-forward radio readers, because we talk about that stuff all the time, the idea of a multiverse of parallel universes, parallel realities. So I love that one, but I don't consider that one really much of a weird fact. To me, that's everyday stuff. I talk about that all the time.
Well, the multiverse is a pretty great one. I love that one. Let's see here. The fundamental description of the universe does not account for the past, present, or future.
Whoa!
Isn't that interesting? So we basically, time is not part of the special theory of relativity. Let me just read this. According to the special theory of relativity, there's no such thing as the present, or the future, or the past. Time frames are relative. I have a time frame. You have a time frame. The third planet on Gliese 581 has a time frame. Ours are similar because we are moving at similar speeds, but the planet at Gliese 581 is going to be a lot different. If we were moving at very different speeds, we would find that one of us aged quicker than the other. Similarly, if one of us was closer than the other to a major gravity well, we would age slower than someone who wasn't. That's interesting. So,
wow. So there's, there's an old song by Chicago from the 70s. Does anybody really know what time it is? And I guess the answer is no. Nobody does, because
depends on where you're at,
Exactly. And we're not just talking time zones. How fast time is moving. And does it say the direction time is moving in? Is that variable from locale to locale, or we don't go quite that far?
Well, here's an interesting fact of how this impacts us in the real world. GPS satellites, of course, are both moving quickly and are a significant distance from the planet Earth. So their internal clocks show a different time to the receivers on the ground. A lot of computing power has to go into making your sat-nav work around the theory of special relativity so that it can point out where you are. It's important to make adjustments for the for how time is passing differently in outer space than it is here on Earth.
Those have got to be like microscopic, very small adjustments, but still the adjustments have to be made, or over time, I guess, they make the whole system unworkable.
That's right. So, interesting, huh?
Astounding, actually.
Yeah, it's an astounding science fact.
It's an astounding science fact, so I guess we'll use that one then to close off, and we'll pick this up again next time when we have another edition of
Astounding Science Facts.
Okay,
well,
so
with that, I will say it's probably time to switch over to our music. But before I do, I just want to remind everyone that we're on three times a week. So please join us Saturday evening and be with us again Monday for the second ever Fast Forward Radio, and next Wednesday night when our special guest, Alex Lightman, will be with us. Alex was just selected by as a winner in the Economist Innovation Awards for 2010. He'll be here talking with us about that, so you don't want to miss that. Stephen, what's our music?
Okay, well, Phil, we actually have a couple minutes left. Maybe it's just because I'm in a, you know, time is passing differently over here, but I see that we got like 4 minutes left. So I want to take just a second and convince you why you don't want to buy a Kindle.
Oh, we were going to get into that. Okay, now this is if you can persuade me not to buy a Kindle, that'll be reasonably astounding. So go for it.
Okay, let me ask you this question first. Do you still have a word processor that's dedicated to just being a word processor in your house and being used on a regular basis?
I've never had that.
Of course you do.
So no, I do not still have
it. No, I mean, and the reason you don't is because the computer on your desk is just fine as a word processor, but it also does all these other wonderful things, including this show.
That's right.
So, that's pretty much why you don't want to buy a Kindle. You want to buy something that does more than just being a Kindle. You could buy an iPad, which will have a Kindle app for it. There's lots of other, you know, devices out there that want to be the iPad killer. But I mean, you know, that's the way it's going to go. I really feel that dedicated ebook readers are going to go the way of the dinosaur, and fairly soon, because these padlock devices are so good even now, and are only going to get better. But you don't feel they're ready. Why aren't they ready, in your opinion?
I need a keyboard. If I get an iPad, I'm still going to need a laptop because I need a keyboard. I'm not ready to make this leap to just hitting glass that has fake keys on it. So even if I bought an iPad, I'd still have a keyboard. I'd still have a laptop. So I'm like, well, I don't know what I need the iPad for. I get music off my iPod, which I still use. I'll tell you, I'm very persuaded by, have you seen the Kindle commercial where the two people are lying by the swimming pool and the guy's got his iPad and he just can't see anything, and he turns to the woman next to him and he says, how are you able to read in this light? And she goes, well, this is a Kindle. And then she mentions how much she paid for it versus how much he paid for his iPad. So I think until they get that display thing working a little bit better, there's still a window for the dedicated book readers. But I'm a bad person to ask about these things because I'm ironically enough, I'm not an early adopter of technology. I will be one of the last people I know to get an iPad. I mean, if I get a Kindle now, I'm way late on the adoption cycle of that, right? But I'm pretty psyched about it. I'm thinking, hey, I think I'm just about ready for a Kindle. See, so.
I've had my Kindle for how long? A year and a half now, I've gone on to the next.
And you never use it because you're Mr. Like, I'll just read it off the iPhone, and I'm like, I can't read a book on an iPhone. Oh, whippersnappers, get off my lawn. I think that your message is not lost on our audience. I think most people listening are going to hear that and they're going to go, oh, Stephen is right. If I have not bought a Kindle yet, I will hold off and I'll probably get another device that's going to address more needs at the same time. But I think you're talking to the wrong person. I'm probably the right person to get a Kindle and hold off and get an iPad a little bit later. But I think your argument is probably sound. It's just you're wasting it on the wrong guy. I think that's
it's too late for me, my son. Okay.
It's too late for me. Exactly. Oh, man, we need audio.
Turn from the dark side.
Okay. That would be most excellent.
Okay. Well, anyway, the music tonight is Pluto Rocks by Subplot A. Now, Subplot A, these are the guys that brought us Every Man a couple of weeks ago that we absolutely loved. So I hope everybody enjoys Pluto Rocks. This is an ode to a certain non-planet that we all know and love. So
the planet that got demoted, Pluto Rocks. All right, Stephen, looking forward to hearing that. Thanks for putting that together, and thanks to everyone for participating. I appreciate you all hanging in the chat room without Sally here. Sally, we look forward to having you back in a couple of weeks, and look forward to being with you all again on Saturday and next Monday, and to being with you again live next Wednesday evening when, once again, our special guest will be Alex Lightman. So until then, live to see it.
got a father who just got a moon of his own. Moon on rocks, don't hurt him no more. Grandfather, Pluto, don't call him no dolphin.